Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territory.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Monday, August 11th. My name is Magnus Teevil, and joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
And we got an interesting show lined up for you today. We are in a few minutes. We'll be bringing you a report about LNG development in the north, and an extended interview with David Hughes of Global Sustainability Research, and this is from our friends up at Seakick Radio up in Smithers, BC. Of course, they are in the epicenter of where a lot of this LNG development is going to happen, and a lot of what the interview will be looking into is what is it going to take to get the natural gas to so it can be exported to markets overseas, and what is going to be the environmental impact of that? A lot of it will depend on technologies like fracking and others, which are very effective at extracting the gas, but come with a lot of costs. Peter, you and Adam had a chat about a
pre-taped thing on Thursday that we're going to be presenting close to the end of the show.
Yep.
And that's going to conclude about 6 weeks of... It started with... we had actually pre-recorded three segments more than 6 weeks ago. It was myself, Adam Tendowski, and Stephen Fan. About some of them, what they said was a bit over my head, but they were... in the course of 3 weeks, these three segments were done, and then I voiced a bit about my bit of disagreement centered on how South Africa was treated during the 1990s. And Adam came, did a pre-recorded segment, and he felt he had a bit more. So this kind of concludes 6 weeks for now.
Excellent. So that's coming up towards the end of the program. And then, of course, we have Gardening with Embark at just after the half hour. And some other interesting segments and some music and a bunch of other stuff. Things happening in the world in the last few days. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has revealed a plan to militarily conquer the remainder of the Gaza Strip. There's some air, most of it is already under Israeli control after almost 2 years of warfare, and his intention is to completely occupy the remaining territory with the goal of eradicating Hamas, and then eventually, so he says, turning it over to Arab authorities, probably some forces from other Arab states, to put in a new government, which supposedly, one of the conditions of that would be there would be no Hamas representation. This plan has come with over the opposition of the Israeli army's leadership, but of course they are subject to the instructions from the government, and it was passed by the Israeli cabinet late last week, with a plan to do it over the next 6 months. So we've already had 2 years of warfare. If you're listening to the program,
not quite, almost.
If you're listening to the program just before this, when they were also talking about this issue and the number of deaths that have already resulted. Nearly 60,000, according to some estimates, which is an awful lot of people. And out of a population of, I think the population of Gaza is a little over 2 million. You know, so that's like 3% of the population has been killed in the fighting so far. What's going to happen when the Israeli defense forces move into a very dense urban area, which will involve a lot of street-to-street, house-to-house fighting, I presume. If you've seen, I'm sure you have seen, you know, pictures or video of areas that have already been subject to fighting, and they're pretty much, you know, those areas are reduced to rubble between, you know, the fighting, the artillery, and airstrikes. And that would presume that the rest of the rest of the urban areas are going to get the same treatment. It's kind of gross.
I'd like to weigh in on a few things.
Yeah, please do.
I actually heard, I just slipped in to the beginning of the show, but I heard Guerrilla Radio on the bus ride up here. And it's interesting that they think the idea of Mark Carney saying, well, it should be a two-state solution is too little, too late. They're very critical. Now, David Frum, who is the son of Barbara Frum, which our younger people will not remember, but anyway, he was actually one of George W. Bush's writers. And he came up with what is the Axis of Evil statement. Yeah. 24 years ago, he sort of said, oh, this is terrible and all this. Now, what it is that, but the show is right. I mean, the Canadian government has been implicit in a certain of support of Israel. But this is sort of Mark Carney's arguably taking an Aristotelian golden means in many ways. Now, why I would say to David Frum, why the two-state solution is a good idea, which he doesn't agree with, is that it stops the illegal settlers. They come with every excuse to go into the Palestinian area, which is illegal even by their own laws, not just international law.
Yeah.
And they have built I don't know if they're quite freeways or highways, but roads into the areas, that's the Palestinian area. And if any Palestinian uses these roads, they are shot, which is illegal. And I think that the idea of the two-state solution, which Mark Carney has publicly said, you know, Mr. Conservative in many ways, is this that, look, you come up with every excuse to even violate your own laws. And I think that's why a lot of people said that we need a two-state solution. Because you find a way to violate your own rules.
And it's worth noting that the activities you're talking about, you know, the additional settler encroachment into the West Bank has been happening at a faster pace over the last couple of years while attention's been focused on the violence in Gaza. And the Israeli government takes a sort of, you know, they talk about doing some stuff about it, but they mostly take a hands-off approach. And there's even, you know, been reports of where you know, Israeli security forces have backed up settlers. You know, settlers go and do something. Some Palestinians resist that in some fashion, and the security forces, the police or whoever it is, come along and, you know, sort of harass the Palestinians for the violence they're doing, even though they're responding to violence.
Right, that's right. And so
the other thing I think is about this is I think. A couple things. One, I think Netanyahu is desperate to keep this war going as long as possible because it holds off a whole bunch of trouble he has, both holding his coalition together and remaining in government. But the fact he's also subject to corruption charges, which are sort of being held in sort of pause until he's no longer in the prime minister or the crisis. Current crisis is over, but he's basically able to avoid sort of, you know, accountability on that as long as he keeps all this up. The other thing I think that's crazy, and this is something you'll recall I said way back when the Israelis first announced they were going to invade into the West Bank back in the fall of 2023, and that their stated goal was to eliminate Hamas. And I think even this latest initiative, this six-month war to completely occupy the Gaza, one of their stated goals is to completely eliminate and crush Hamas, and I don't think they'll do it. I think it's a fool's errand. Even now, I bet that they are burying stockpiles of weapons throughout the region, which, you know, the Israelis will go in, they'll occupy stuff, they'll find some of it, they won't find others, when, in theory, you know, Israeli forces withdraw to allow some other Arab force or whatever to take over administration. Hamas will come right back out, dig out those weapons, and be back in the game. I think the idea that they can be defeated that way is not realistic. And all this killing for this goal is for a goal they can't achieve anyway. And because they can't achieve it, they can just keep on going. Because, you know, who would have thought in November or December 2023, when Israel first started to roll into Gaza, that they'd still be fighting and still be killing and still being opposed here, whatever we are, 22 months later,
yeah.
21 months on, against, you know, supposedly one of the most effective military forces in the world, the Israeli army. And they've been at it 2 years, and they're not even close to eliminating Hamas. So how's this 6 months going to do it? How many people are going to have to die for this goal that they can't even achieve? And with the whole war going on, mostly just to keep Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition partners in power.
Well, unfortunately, with the secularization, as secular, non-practicing Jewish forces in Israel have used illegal settlers,
mm-hmm.
I think, because the illegal settler is going by a very extreme type of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I mean, they kind of remind me of Nancy, the comic strip. They had a strip once where she goes to a pet store and there's this big tank of goldfish, and she points to one goldfish and says, "I want that one." In a sense that, why don't you just have another goldfish on top? And the thing I would say to the illegal settlers, okay, you may not get exactly what you want, but you are part of a nation of Israel. You have this kind of, this particular concept in your ideology that it has to be that.
Yeah.
And you're really taking away from people that are just living there. And a lot of the non-practicing Jewish people are backing them up because I guess they feel that sort of strengthens them, you know. So, I'm not a supporter 100% of Hamas or what has been done, but I think there's kind of a thin wedge between approvable and saying it's understandable what they've done. Like a lot of the extremism on the Palestinian side becomes understandable. Not that I'm agreeing with it.
Yeah, I know what
you
mean.
But it's a question of being, of saying it's understandable why this situation has happened. So I'm not going to agree with it. And a lot of the rest of the, I mean, Saudi Arabia for years, this was going back maybe 30 years. When they used to have these bombers, they used to go into a part of Israel and explode. Saudi Arabia used to fund the family of the, and it would be known, you know, like Saudi Arabia.
They would reward a family of a suicide bomber.
And then they sort of wash their hands of it now. And it sort of, I think if there was more agreement with all the Islamic world, mm-hmm. perhaps Israel would have had an easier time of it. You know, that there's problems of Palestinians being third class or even worse citizens on the part of the Arab world or the Islamic world. But I think it's also they're the power broker, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So we can say, okay, you know, you may be. Hamas has done things wrong. The Palestinians have done. The rest of the Arab world have. But you're the power broker, and you're really should be taking some other stance than you're taking now.
Well, it's a bit like the whole food crisis in Gaza, where Israel completely controls both the borders, most of the borders, and the waterfront, and can control all the access in and out of supplies and stuff, and then somehow washes their hands and says it's not our fault. People don't have enough to eat. But who else's fault is it if you control all the access? I mean, you can decide to let trucks in or not let trucks in. As long as you decide to not let trucks in, there's going to be shortages and potential starvation.
I get how do you say the prime minister's name? We'll say it wrong.
Netanyahu.
You can just
call him Bibi. That's easier.
Although
it's such a cute name, it's a bit offensive.
Netanyahu. He knows how to always come up with some argument, you know, and it just becomes like some esoteric argument, and then he just goes, "Oh, but this is quite obvious." And said, "Well, you're a bit convoluted in your logic, and so on." You know, it just, and there may even be seeds of the truth in some of his statements. But anyway,
yeah. I mean, one final point, and another thing I think Netanyahu's protecting himself from is the fact that, you know, the October 7th attack. Part of the reason it was possible was because Israelis had shifted deployments from that region of the Gaza border over to the West Bank, you know, partly to deal with, you know, and to somewhat support the settler activity that was going on. But, you know, they weakened that section of the border, which was why they were able to have, you know, so many Hamas fighters cross the border. That should never have happened, you know. And, you know, the government sort of allowed that to happen by these deployments. And, of course, until this whole crisis ends, you know, that's not going to be examined. And the government, you know, and Netanyahu himself and his ministers are sort of another issue they're able to avoid.
See, this is the problem. It's not just international law. It's their own laws that are against the international settlers.
Yeah.
Which I'm just reinforcing something I've said, but I was unaware of what you just brought up.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Okay. Yeah, we got to wrap this up, but we're going to run out of time for our other segments. All right. Let's. We have a report from our friends up at CICK Radio in Smithers. It's an interview with Earth scientist David Hughes of Global Sustainability Research about what it's going to take to get the natural gas to support the hope for LNG boom here in BC. Here is our report from Dan Messick at CICK.
The government of BC approved the substantial start for the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline, which, if completed, would feed fracked gas to BC's northeast to an export terminal near the mouth of the Nass River. The Cy Lisms LNG project is being billed as the first Indigenous-owned and led LNG project of its kind, along with the backing of a Texas-based gas company called Western LNG. The Nisga Nation is looking to build the newest BC LNG project. This comes on the heels of the government of BC's push to see several major industry projects move forward in the hopes of diversifying markets amid the U.S. trade war with the passing of Bill 5. However, there are already legal challenges of the LNG project and the Prince Rupert gas transmission in the courts, and more are expected to follow. There is also strong Gitxsan and non-Indigenous opposition to the pipeline, and hundreds of Nisga members have also signed petitions in opposition of the Cy Lisms export terminal. At the same moment, we are seeing intense flaring in Kitimat as LNG Canada's LNG export facility gears up to ship out its first tanker of LNG in the coming months. Although we often hear about the opposition and support for these projects here in the northwest of British Columbia, we rarely hear about where all this gas is coming from and what is going to be needed in the future to support increased production of BC's LNG industry. Today, we speak with Earth scientist David Hughes of Global Sustainable Research, who spent 32 years with the Geological Survey of Canada and has conducted extensive research into Canada's unconventional and potential gas production capacity. We spoke to him about the potential of growth in BC's LNG industry and what the potential drawbacks are within that growth. Stay with us.
There's a whole litany of new projects. I guess the Casilisms is one up near you. There's LNG Canada, which is underway. There's Cedar.
Yeah.
There's the Squamish one. And there's another one down south. And then there's Casilisms.
Yeah.
So that would be five altogether, including LNG Canada.
And so it seems like this, you know, according to the, you know, the paper, how many wells are actually going to be needed to feed all of this LNG? And I remember, you know, something in the way of, you know, basically thousands, you know, tens of thousands possibly of new wells. Is that still the case? Is that kind of what, you know, according to the,
yeah, I mean,
the paper?
I had an estimate in my paper. Well, they'd be horizontal wells. So you could drill, you know, maybe 15 or 20 of them from a single well pad. So it's not quite as bad as the old days where they drilled, you know, one well per pad. So they'd have very long horizontal laterals.
I see.
You know, typically 9 or 10,000 feet per lateral is not unusual. And some of them would go longer than that. So, but you still need, you know, roads to access them. I've got an estimate of the total amount of land destroyed or affected, I think. So it really depends on what scenario. So the global net zero scenario, if you look on page 40, I've got a chart that has estimates.
Yeah.
And, yeah, global net zero is 12,500. But, when you look at what Trump is doing down south and what Ebby is talking about with this Bill 15.
Yes.
Which sounds basically like a, you know, whole hog. Forget about climate change. Forget about global warming. So basically, that the 12,500 is in the most restrictive scenario, where Canada actually achieves its net zero, and it just gets worse from there. You know, at 19,000, if Canada gets to net zero, but the world doesn't. And business as usual is 32,000. So, yeah, 12,000 is absolutely best case. And then land surface disturbance is on page 41. So I made some basic assumptions about, you know, how many wells per pad and how much road access you need for each well. So you're looking at over 100 square kilometers in the best case scenario. You know, global net zero is, that's just in BC.
Yeah.
And then 130 or more in Alberta. So that, the best case scenario is probably about 250 square kilometers get decimated. And it gets much worse for the other scenarios. Yeah. And, you know, the way the world is going, the Canada net zero scenario is probably the most realistic. And, you know, probably quite optimistic. You know, personally, I don't think the way things are going, especially with Trump south of the border, we're going to meet our net zero by 2050 commitments. I think that's pretty unrealistic at this point.
Obviously, a lot of this means potentially more money, more jobs. But there's a lot of other issues that come along with that. I mean, just looking at, as you mentioned, the land disturbance, you know, is there any kind of indication what this will do to you know, arable land. You know, there's obviously got to be First Nations interests and all this. But that's not the research you've looked into. You've just looked at kind of the numbers of, you know, what is required and where this is possibly headed in these scenarios. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And if you look at, you know, First Nations would be mostly on the BC side.
Yeah.
But they would control a lot of it.
Like a lot of the drilling.
Yeah, and really the BC side has the best quality wells. They're the most productive. And it's also closer to the coast. So, I would think that, a disproportionate amount of the gas will come out of the BC side. And therefore, be more subject to First Nations.
Yeah.
The Alberta side is more in the agricultural part. Although part of the BC Montney is in agricultural land too, mm-hmm. but less than Alberta.
You know, what's the size of that deposit? How long could this, what's the estimate for how long this could go on for to see these developments?
Well, basically, the Montney is the last great golden hope for Canada's gas. You know, I'm just working on a project. I'm going through all the gas plays in North America with a commercial database. And if you look at the other plays in BC, like the Horn River or the Liard River, they're basically finished. I mean, the only real growth potential in BC is the Montney. And if you look at Alberta, it's sort of the same. I mean, a lot of those plays are quite mature. And, sure, there's going to be more gas, but it doesn't last forever. This is non-renewable resource we're talking about. Basically, the government proposal seems to think gas is infinite. And we'll just sell it off as fast as we possibly can. And it seems that climate change was a big concern with the BC government, but not so much anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one other thing I want to ask you about there, David. You had mentioned that, the production of the wells on the BC side are more efficient, that there's more production on that side. With this, this whole boom coming, what do you envision is going to be needed to, obviously you're going to need to drill more new wells, but what do you envision is going to happen if this boom continues to that area?
There's already, I was just looking at it, something over 14,000 wells drilled on the BC side of the border in the Montney. And there's going to be a lot more wells drilled. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm just looking at, I'm in my database now, and some of the operators on the BC side of the border are like Ovintiv, Tourmaline, Petronas, Cambrian Energy, Arc Resources, Paramount, Canadian Natural Resources, and then there's a few others, but that's on the BC side of the border.
David, I know you've been looking into this stuff for a long time, and you work with the Geological Survey of Canada. I mean, I'm curious to know your thoughts on, we often hear this, this discussion of, gas is LNG, it's a transitional fuel, to get us to the next phase of renewable energy, just get us through this last bit. But also, you know, and I hear this more often now than before, in the clean LNG, and I wonder, you know, when you're doing this research, when you're